Thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. And for the three out of the last four podcasts, we're not going to be talking about stuff on the pitch, so you might find this listen bearable. I've got a friend who's been suggesting this guest for some time on the podcast. It's football related, it's about football marketing, digital marketing. I know some people might say, well, at this time, surely the most important thing's on the pitch, but trying to take a wider view of some of the implications, particularly as we have a new CEO who's from a marketing communications background, and we've just signed up with a new partner. So just wanted to get a bigger feel. I'm always interested in how we can generate more money at the club so we can get better players on the pitch so that what we're watching becomes really good and we do really well. So I hope you find the following guest as interesting as I did. So this is me, Harry Brady, with Anthony Murray, and we are chatting with Stephen Hutchison of a company called Fuse. Slightly different this week. Anthony Murray is on as usual. We are not going to talk about yellow in the Celtic strip or anything like that. But we've got a different guest this week who will go through his Celtic credentials. So I'm joined by Stephen Hutchison. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm good, thank you. Good after a win at the weekend.
Yes, so much better after the weekend. So before we get into the meat and bones of what you're on to talk about, we need to set out your Celtic credentials. So first up is, who was your first Celtic hero and what was your first Celtic game?
Yeah, so first of all, my dad deserves a lot of credit for my Celtic credentials because I've lived in England since I was 2 years old, in the north of England, and then latterly down south, and I live in London myself now. So he did well to keep me Celtic through and through, despite growing up in England where there weren't too many Celtic fans at school and so on. My first Celtic game, I remember it well. It was in I can't remember the exact date, if I'm honest. I was trying to remember, but I can't remember. It was Celtic versus Motherwell at Celtic Park in the early 90s, and it was a 1-1 draw. And my grandpa told me afterwards that I wasn't allowed back because I was a jinx. So I remember that very well. So that was my first Celtic game. It must have been around 91, 92, because I was old enough to remember it. So I'd have been sort of 7 or 8, I think, coming up from England to see family. And my first Celtic hero was John Collins, actually. And I met him after that game. I met him in the car park. I got Andy Walker to take the photo. My dad got Andy Walker's photo of me and John Collins, which obviously looking back now, that was quite a wise thing to do rather than having it with him in it. But yeah, that was my first hero. But my overall hero was Henrik. When I was growing up, he was the man. So, but yeah, John Collins was the first hero for me.
Yeah, good use for Andy Walker there.
Exactly.
Taking photos.
Best thing you've done.
But your hero's John Collins, so... Stephen, Anthony Murray, Stephen. Anthony quite likes the idea of John Collins being there in Celtic Park, don't you, Anthony?
I'm a huge, huge Collins fan. And it's a safe answer for that question, because on my podcast debut, I made the mistake of going honest. Slightly older than you, Stephen. I went with Mo Johnson. Oh, what a backlash.
Have I told you my Mo Johnson story about how he's still a Celtic fan?
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, maybe. And actually, who was it? Because I was defending Celtic tweeting happy birthday Brendan Rodgers. and somebody said, what next, Mo Johnson? well, I don't know. Tell me, you guys, do you think there's ever a point where Mo Johnson, the club could say happy birthday Mo Johnson in a tweet?
No. No chance. I think Brendan's a bit different because probably since he left, I mean, not that when he left it was, I don't think he'll be forgiven for the way he left, but given the problems we've since seen, people can maybe understand his position a bit more than they did, but I don't think what Mo did can ever be understood or forgiven, in my opinion anyway.
Anthony? I think, surely the clubs, are, from the point of view of some members of the fan base, you know, our USP is surely the fact we're a bunch of forgivers. No? And surely everything is, you know, everyone is, nobody's beyond salvation. So, he has to mea culpa, say he made a mistake, but at that point we forgive him and welcome him back.
Well, so if he says, I'm sorry.
I wish I'd signed for the Celtic in 88-89, whenever it was.
See, my problem with Mo Johnson is I think one of the greatest goals ever scored was finished by Mo Johnson, which is the third goal, I think it was, in the 5-0
victory. Love Street, yeah.
Oh, yeah, what a goal that was, yeah.
Yeah, so, anyway, we got you on to talk a wee bit different. You're not a football coach, Stephen. Do you want to introduce and explain exactly what it is you do?
Yeah, it's a bit complicated. Everyone says, if you can explain, can you try and explain it as if you're talking to your gran? And it's not that easy. It's not rocket science either. I'm not trying to claim that. It's just a bit complicated. So I work for a company called Fuse. And what we are, we're essentially sports marketing. So we help brands enter into sponsorship and partnership agreements and then activate and manage those partnerships. So how they present themselves as a partner of whatever they're sponsoring to the world. We also do work with the other side, what we'd call rights holders, so the likes of Celtic, who are the people that are sponsored, and we help them through trying to advise them on commercial issues, such as how can they attract more sponsors, different types of sponsors, how can they make more money from their existing sponsors, how can they create rights and assets that brands are going to want to buy from them, and I suppose to try and bring it to life and make it easy to understand some of the things we work on. So Nissan is a big client of ours. So we've taken them into a sponsorship of the Champions League, and we help them market that around the world. Same with PepsiCo and Santander. We look after Vodafone, who are sponsors of the British and Irish Lions. We've done lots of work in Formula One and the Olympics as well. So, yeah, largely we work with brands who become sponsors of events, personalities, teams, that kind of thing.
So one of the things people might be listening to this saying, yeah, we're a football team, so what are we talking about all this for? How would you sell to somebody the reason why Celtic should be employing a firm like Fuse, an ordinary fan, not a boardroom pitch, an ordinary fan?
Yeah, I think what we can do, and it's not just us, but what we can do is help entities like Celtic understand their value, you know, what they should be charging brands for engaging with Celtic. There's obviously a reality to market forces with that as well. It's not just as simple as, oh, because you reach this many people, you should pay this, because there are, you know, there's competition, there's other market forces at play. We can also help them identify new and innovative ways in which they can make money different ways. We can identify all the money that's available on the table. They don't have to activate it all, because some things, which I'm sure we'll get on to discuss, maybe aren't the smartest thing to activate, whether that's going to receive fan backlash or just make them too cluttered and actually harm their sell to other brands. You know, if a brand is one of 50 brands, they might not see it as premium as it might be. So I think it's basically just the understanding of what is possible, and perhaps making sure you get the most value from your partnerships that you can. But, you know, I suppose in defense of entities like Celtic, it isn't easy for them. You know, it's a very hard market, and the position we're in, whilst we're strong in our market, you know, to attract the best brands, we're up against the biggest clubs in the world. And quite frankly, the reach that we have compared to some of them, no matter what we think of ourselves in terms of fan base and history and all that, it just makes us start from a losing position. But as I say, that's why I think they actually should look at things to be more innovative, and how they can activate different money in a different way more, because they are starting from that slightly losing position. So it's more important for them than ever to try and make sure that they are being innovative and driving money they can to try and bridge that gap.
Okay, because for me, one of the things that in everything you've said, it's a very cluttered marketplace.
Yeah,
there's all these football clubs, and of course, everybody's wanting eyeballs on their brand that's associated with that football club. So that draws the bigger brands to the bigger football clubs. I don't think, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we are clear enough in our, and I know fans don't like the terms brand and all that type of stuff, but for the purposes of this conversation, I don't think we are clear enough in differentiating our brand from other clubs by using the USP of formed in 1887 / 88 to put dinner on the tables of the poor kids in the East End of Glasgow, having the Celtic FC Foundation generating more funds during this pandemic, for example, than major Premiership clubs have done. I don't think we are strong enough on focusing on that's who we are as a brand. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think, you know, again, given the situation we're in our market and compared to other football clubs that we might be competing against, we need to leverage the things that we've got that are different. And things like the Celtic Foundation, for example, is exactly one of those that I think is very powerful for us. However, I suppose where I come down on this is it's difficult, because if you think about it, you know, Man United, which is kind of renowned as the biggest commercial club in the world as far as sponsors, and so they went down a route of, you know, you could become the official tea bag of Man United in Czech Republic. You know, they went that far down, and that was because, you know, Man United Premier League is the most broadcast. They were obviously not so much now, but they were winning everything. They had some icons like Beckham and Giggs and Keane and people like that. But what the brands weren't buying into, they weren't buying into the history of Manchester United. They were buying into the fact that you stick a Man United logo on a teabag pack and people are going to go, oh, that's cool. It's got Man United's logo on it, especially in other markets outside the UK, because obviously in the UK, we're very tribal with our clubs. So you put Man United logo on something, or a Celtic logo, a Rangers logo, whatever, you're potentially alienating a number of fans. But outside the UK, where obviously some of those big deals come into play, they're not buying into the history. So I suppose the differentiators we have aren't really the things that will drive more money for us. I think what it would do is make it would drive money in the sense, not immediately, because for what I'm trying to get at is, if we were to do some more content ourselves or with partners, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm sure you guys have come across the likes of Copper 90 and Ball Street and entities like that, which are kind of fan media platforms. If we were to do documentaries and insights, you'll have more eyes from football fans on Celtic, perhaps more people talking about Celtic, and in turn that leads to people, you know, the Celtic brand being more viewed by people, perhaps in a positive way, talked about on social media, which in turn might lead to money because we can make the argument. But brands themselves, by and large, aren't really associating with clubs because they want to tell a story about the club's history. They're looking to try and leverage something the club has got for their own benefit. And that's a challenge for Celtic. And that's where I do sympathise with them a bit in terms of their commercial power. You know, look, I'm sure we'll get onto it, but I'm not saying I think they do everything right, but it isn't the easiest balance for them to strike. You know, the Daffabet deal, for example, is Celtic's biggest in history, but it's largely condemned by the fan base. And I get why, obviously, because it's gambling and so on. But it's not like we've got brands queuing up to be on the Celtic shirt, because the benefit of being on the Celtic shirt isn't necessarily there in terms of exposure. Betting companies are one of the few sectors who will gobble up just eyeballs through football. You know, at the time, Daffabet had, I think, Celtic, Sunderland, there's another club they had as well, I forget now, but they were just going, so there, and then Celtic got a decent deal out of that. I understand the criticism, and that might, you know, gambling might not be around forever, but it's not like they could have gone out and gone for, you know, when Chevrolet are sponsoring Man United, are they going to sponsor Celtic instead? Probably not. So it's not the easiest. But I suppose to come back to your original point, we definitely don't leverage the differentiator, how much our fans care about the club compared to the majority. The Celtic Foundation, how much good work that does. The amount of fans we take to away European games. All this stuff can be put together in terms of content and things like that that make the brand of Celtic more known outside of the market we operate in, and that all works towards attracting more business our way. But it is hopefully I've been clear, it's a tricky dynamic for them to balance.
So it's what you're saying, what they need to do, this is what I'm my understanding of what you just said, they need to work on creating that brand by doing the innovative content, the documentaries that focus on the parts of the brand that we are wanting to reinforce, and it will be a gradual process to then work with slightly different companies that helps you develop that brand, that then gets you success in the pitch, which will then get you the bigger brands to come to you, you know, that it's all this.
I think so. But I think what I'm trying to say is it's not just by leveraging our differentiator, it's not going to bridge the gap that we have to the top. So we are in a position of where it's a challenge. But what I'm trying to say is, using a simple example, let's say we did a content feature on Celtic away trips if it was in Scotland plus the European trips, and they focused on that content, and then they could offer that to a brand to say, you know, a relevant brand that could be the partner of it, and they might be able to do something in that content where they give Celtic fans exclusive, I'm trying to think of an example, like, you know, they could, if you say like Heineken or someone who are well across football, they could, or Carlsberg actually, I was trying to think of, sorry, you know, they're probably the best. They could do something where they could turn some fans' experience an away game at Celtic into probably the best away game they've ever experienced, give them a box for themselves and their friends to use, something like that. So we're creating content out, and it's relevant to fans because, sponsor or no sponsor, people are going to want to watch the scenes when Celtic score and the fans go mental, the singing in the, you know, we've got to be a bit careful, but the singing in the pubs beforehand, people on the way to matches and all that kind of stuff. There's a relevance to the ordinary fan. So it's not like you're just creating, you know, because no one likes what, there's one of the things I always say when I'm doing things in the industry, there's a misnomer in the marketing industry that people like and want to see advertising. It's a necessary evil that exists to help fund programming, help fund, in football's case, clubs' income, and whether that buys players or whatever you have. It's a necessary evil. Fans aren't going, I cannot wait to see the next, even the top Nike commercial. When it comes out, people go, oh, that's quite cool, but they're not before it going, when is the next Nike ad coming out? So what I'm trying to say is, what you're doing with that content is you're creating something that's interesting for your average fan, be that a Celtic fan or another fan who just likes to consume football stuff, seeing the experience of what it's like to be a fan. So almost cameras away from the pitch, looking at the fans traveling to the game, you know, being with their friends and family, their journey to the match, all that kind of stuff. And then a brand can add a bit of value during that journey. And, you know, the Carlsberg example I gave, relevant to their brand, probably the best away game, just a little feature in it that gives something. So you're creating content that people watch. So it's got a critical mass of people watching it. It's relevant to Celtic, so it's not completely uncredible. And then you're offering something for a brand within it, we're going to pay for the benefit to do it because you've got a number of views, it's relevant to their brand, and you've got the association there. That's the kind of thing I'm getting at. But that isn't going to be game-changing money for Celtic. I just think it's money that they've left on the table by not leveraging some of the USPs that we have.
So one of the things you focused on, the passion of the fans there, and, you know, I've been told, you know, by the most senior people at Celtic, and I know, you know, you don't end up being Scotland fans who get applauded all the way around the world for being losers. But, you know, I've been told that clubs and the most elite people in UEFA will comment to Celtic that the reason they like coming to Celtic Park is because it's still like coming to a football ground of 20 plus years ago, where you can feel the passion of the supporters in every aspect of it.
Yeah.
So do you think that's, and I get the impression actually, they don't get hung up on the songs that we're singing as much as we do domestically, because they don't really get the words and it passes them by anyway.
Well, especially in the stadium as well, because the songs in the stadium by and large are, you know, they're not dangerous in the same way that some others outside in the pubs and stuff might be. The stadium is definitely one. I mean, again, living in England, just even in England, which is close to Scotland, obviously, the people are so impressed. I've taken a few friends up to Celtic Park for either Celtic Rangers games or Champions League matches, and they're always blown away by it. And, you know, I work with UEFA for a lot, as I mentioned at the start, and they do always say that Celtic Park and Dortmund and Anfield are their three favourite grounds they go to. You know, so my comment back to them is always, well, why are you trying to create the tournament then that makes it as difficult as possible for Celtic to be in it? So it only goes so far, obviously, because those kind of occasions are few and far between. And so what I'm trying to get at, though, is we should leverage our fans a lot more. The only downside is, in the way that football is carved up commercially, Celtic, you know, if it's Champions League, Celtic don't own the rights to the footage of the match. They obviously can focus on footage of fans, but it's quite difficult, I suppose, to package that up week after week after week when all you're seeing is fans singing You'll Never Walk Alone, maybe just cheering when a goal goes in, or singing some of the other songs, you know, doing the huddle or whatever. It's great, but can you, how much can you make of that for year on year on year when it's the same kind of thing over and over again? You know, I'm not saying it's not of value. It definitely is. It just, it's not enough on its own, really, just to make you know, enough of a difference.
So if we were, if we to package that and want to try and develop, because for me, you know, I'm interested in this side of things because the more money we get through the turnstile, the better players we can get in the park, the better players we get in the park, the more enjoyable I find watching Celtic play, strangely enough. Is there a route, if we were consistently playing in Champions League football, is there a route for us to move away from the domestic marketing revenues that on the whole we've got and get these bigger brands who will give us more money? Or are we always the prisoner of being in Scotland?
We are a bit of the prisoner, because I'll come on to an idea I've got in a second which would make us more money, I believe. But first and foremost, again, if I go back to the way commercially it's carved up, so the Champions League has its sponsors. So it has eight sponsors. And the club sponsor, so Dafabet, for example, other than being on the shirt, they don't get any rights to Champions League matches, because UEFA own, it's essentially a UEFA event. UEFA come into Celtic Park a couple of days before the match, and they actually go around and they redress the stadium. So other than obviously when it's painted on the seats, they will go around and, you know, Adidas, when Celtic had Nike as the kit supplier, they will actually go around and cover up the Nike logo around the stadium. And obviously that's just one example of a small piece of branding. What say Dafabet, Magners, and obviously people like Nike in the past wouldn't be able to do is leverage the Champions League aspect of Celtic, because UEFA own those rights and those sponsors have exclusive rights to activate those matches. So as a result, what the brands who sponsor Celtic are paying for is, if we were regular Champions League competitors, would be on the shirt, on the back of the shirt, things like that, the branding and the increased audience that watch Champions League matches versus domestic SPFL games. So moving on from that, the idea I've had always is that if you look at our sponsors, largely, you know, if it's Tennent's, Magners, Dafabet, largely they're interested in the domestic market. And that's obviously, that yields a certain price, because they're not going to pay Celtic for global exposure. Number one, we don't have enough of it versus some other teams that they could potentially sponsor. Number two, you know, especially, I suppose, in the alcohol example, they are really targeting the UK/Scotland/Ireland market with that sponsorship. So as a result, I think Celtic would be within their rights to maybe charge them less money than they do, but to say to them, we're actually going to carve up your rights here. We're going to say, you're going to be across our shirt for all domestic matches, but we're going to go out to the market and try and sell for European matches alone. And what you might get is especially at the moment with the money coming over from the Far East, you might get if we qualify for the Champions League and they know we've got six group stage matches that are going to get a certain amount of audience, they might say, well, we'll pay you for those six matches. And they might pay as a premium versus, you know, what you would be able to charge for your average domestic game. So I've always had the idea that what Celtic could do to leverage, because one of the advantages we should have, I know we don't want to get too much into the playing side, but one of the advantages we have that I think is a huge commercial error from Celtic, because we should have obviously qualified for the Champions League way more than we have. And again, not getting into the playing side of it, but I think the commercial knock-on effect that has is huge, because not only if you think about the gate receipts and extra ticket sales you'd get from Champions League matches, plus the revenue you get from being in the Champions League, 25, 30 million for being in the group stage. That aside, you also forgo sponsorship opportunities like this, where you can go out and say, look, we've got six matches, we've got Barcelona and Bayern Munich in our group, so we're going to be playing in some big matches that drive audiences. Would you want to be in the front of our shirt? And certain markets, like the Chinese markets, some of the Asian markets, just want exposure. They just want the exposure, especially the gambling market. And again, I know there are some issues with that, but we could there's money left on the table is kind of what I'm saying. It's not easy. You might not get it, but why not try, I suppose. And I don't know for certain they haven't, but things like that, I think we can take advantage, because, you know, other than the very, very top English clubs, the advantage Celtic has over a lot of, you know, your Evertons, your Aston Villas, your et cetera, is we could be in the Champions League every single year. And that's an advantage. And then we could make more money, not only from the revenue from being in it, but also sponsorship ideas like that, that we don't.
It's interesting that you say whether we do or we don't, because one of the things that's been noticeable in the last few years is there must be something within our contracts, but because when we've had alcohol sponsors on our jerseys, and I think even with some of the betting ones, there's been occasionally where there's been countries we've played in that patently have an issue with, and we've had the Celtic Foundation.
That's big. So France is the... I suppose the most well-known example of that, where they have, I forget the name of it, it's in French, where they don't allow any alcohol advertising at all. So when you're playing at Celtic Park, it's okay, because the game is in Scotland and the UK doesn't have that regulation. But if you're playing in France, you can't have any alcohol brand. And yeah, so obviously the issue would be if you're playing, if we're trying to attract certain brands, there would be some restrictions if it was an alcohol brand or a gambling brand. But I suppose I'm trying to get at the general, just going out and saying for 6 matches, we'll charge you this one-off fee and it's an uplift. You don't have to be our sponsor all year round. But yes, there are restrictions, and we've obviously gone for the Celtic Foundation, which I think is, again, it's a balance between doing the right thing and making money. Because you know, it's nice for the fans and it's good for the culture of the club to have the foundation front and centre of the team, and it's close to Celtic's values. So again, this is the line that you have to draw. And what I was getting at earlier in terms of our work we do with teams like Celtic is you look at what money you could make available on the table, and you might make a choice to not activate it because Celtic have decided that because of their values, because of the culture of the club, they don't want to go out and find a Chinese betting brand to sponsor the Champions League matches. They want to leverage the foundation and be close, true to that. What I'm getting at is just, if we're trying to leverage our differentiators, either that as a culture of a club, history of the club, or the fact that we can get in, that we have access to Champions League, which not many teams do, then we should look at, if it's all about money, we should be trying to leverage that and try and make money from that. And I'm not sure we've done enough of that over the years. When we have, the fact that we haven't qualified as many times as we should is part of the problem. But when we have, I'm not sure we've thought about how we could maximize the opportunity from it commercially.
So I always think of how we can get elite people into Celtic when we can't afford them. And I think of the fact, you know, I've worked most of my life in an environment where you have a basic salary and a commission, so you have commissions on it. And I always think about the Barcelona deal that they had to get Cruyff as a player the very first time, which was they offered him a huge percentage, their average attendance was whatever it was, and they offered him a huge percentage of the uplift in ticket sales between what the existing average was and what, and that Cruyff coming in, they went from something like 50,000 to 90,000 filling the new camp, and he made a fortune and it transformed them as a club. And so what you're saying now, one of the things I've been thinking of late, of the way that we can put together a package that brings in an elite coach, the most elite coach we can afford, would be to offer an enormous bonus for achieving Champions League football.
Yeah.
Because if we're playing without Champions League football, then offering him a bonus. And so what you're describing then adds to that. You know, if we're getting extra revenue because we've got a different shirt sponsor in our Champions League games, then it's even more reason for having an elite coach and saying your basic salary's $1.5 million, but you've got a £4 million bonus if you reach Champions League group stages.
And it makes sense, right? I mean, I don't know obviously what was in the likes of Brendan Rodgers, Martin O'Neill, Neil Lennon, Strachan's contract. I don't know if they had that already. But, you know, you think about the philosophy of the club. Peter Lowell gets his bonus based on Celtic revenue. So it's always been crazy to me that we haven't, again, I really try not to get into the playing side here, but we haven't tried and prepared ourselves earlier for the qualifiers, because it's win-win, right? Because we've obviously over the last few years as well had some assets. Kieran Tierney is one of the most recent examples where if we'd have prepared for Celtic must have known that it was likely that bids were going to come in for him, and they obviously must have known roughly what they would sell him for. So if we knew that actually we could push the boat out a bit to try and get, whether it's a couple of players in January or just go early in the transfer window in the summer, get a couple of players in, and knowing that we're going to sell Tierney, and that will give, and the players we're bringing in will give us, because Tierney isn't going to make or break Celtic's Champions League qualification, right? But we know we're getting money from him, and bring a cup and be better prepared. Then I've never understood why we haven't done more of this, because if you think about it, you've then got a situation where we earn 25 million from Kieran Tierney. We've spent a bit of money on some players from that 25 million, but we're earning an extra 25 million from being in the Champions League itself. And if you then, on top of that, to your point, offer people larger bonuses for doing that, then you're still net way above what you are if you don't qualify for the Champions League, and all you've got is the 25 million Kieran Tierney money that then has to almost supplement the lost income from not being in Europe's elite competition. It's kind of a strange model. So I suppose I suppose the other thing with regards to the coach is, given the way Celtic has been run, the coach's bonus, I don't think the coach, if it's Brendan or Neil Lennon, is actually fully in control of in being able to achieve that bonus. Because, if you, you know, again, I know there's all sorts of rumours, but if you go back to the John McGinn saga, and again, I'm not trying to say he was, you know, the right or wrong, but it was actually the CEO that seemed to be the one that was, you know, Brendan wanted him, and Brendan was then handed it over to the CEO to negotiate. The CEO couldn't negotiate it, rightly or wrongly. So then Brendan's one player down on his, what he sees as his team to be able to maximise the opportunity on the pitch. So actually his opportunity to activate that bonus is less. So if you're a coach coming in going, well, yeah, they've offered me this big bonus, but the chances of me achieving it are somewhat diminished because I'm not fully in control of being able to deliver that bonus, it does become somewhat problematic. But where I think you can get to the, you know, if you write into a Dafabet contract, we reserve the right. I mean, it's not easy because these sponsors will, Dafabet would push back to say, well, hang on, one of the reasons we're sponsoring you is because you're in Europe. So I'm not saying it's easy, but try and negotiate a clause whereby if Celtic qualify for the Champions League, Dafabet's fee comes down. An opportunity, if they can negotiate a brand from, to just sponsor the six Champions League games, Dafabet's fee comes down by whatever percent, but Celtic then make the money from selling a one-off or six-match, sorry, sponsorship package to another. You're potentially opening up the opportunity to earn more money. That's what I think. Those are the kind of things I think we should be doing that we haven't done enough of to try and leverage the different and things that are a bit more in our control as well. So yeah, that's what I suppose my point of view on that.
Anthony, Have you got any questions for Stephen?
I guess I'm slightly cynical about our potential.
Yeah.
Because of, it was actually when I was working at Celtic Park as a community coach, I overheard a conversation, and it was basically the gist of it was the reality that Celtic aren't the big global player that we pretend we are.
Yeah.
Yes, we all love them, but I mean the essential fact is that, you know, the lion's share of people that pay for Celtic TV are people that live within 25 miles of Glasgow, and then you've got stragglers like me and folk, you know, in Argentina and here, there, and everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, they're still just expats who are Tims.
Yep, totally.
So although they peddle this idea that we're this big player, I think we need to take the reality that we're not, and plan accordingly. I guess what I'd want to ask is that, you know, the potential to encourage foreigners to support the Celtic is the Nakamura, you know, the Ki Sun Yong.
Yeah.
How influential would a signing like that be, or marketable? Is, you know, maybe the numbers actually never backed it up, but I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
Huge. I mean, first of all, to your point, totally. Celtic are a massive, in terms of what we would consider proper fans, Celtic are huge. But, you know, what the dynamic around the world, and I'll go back to my example I gave about Man United and this sort of teabag thing, in other markets, particularly, you know, where there are large populations with you know, money to spend, They are fans of multiple teams. You know, if you go to like India, China, there will be Man United and Man City fans there. That's their first team is Man United, their second team is Man City. No, there's no situation where their second team is Celtic, really. That wouldn't happen. unless, to your point, you're right. You look at Nakamura for sure. I mean, again, we still have a disadvantage that Nakamura was the era has changed a bit. You know, that when, if you know, I know there was a debate on Twitter a while back. I can't remember who started it, but one of the ex pundits or something said that the current Celtic team would be better than the Martin O'Neill team. And I think obviously, like, football's changed in terms of tactics, so maybe they would beat them because of athleticism or whatever. And John Hartson, for example, might not be the player now that he was back then. But I suppose, comparatively speaking, if you actually take out that kind of the change of football style, in terms of the standing of the players that Celtic had in world football, irrespective of how tactics and the way the game's played has changed, the Celtic team back, we were buying players and had players that we wouldn't get in a million years now. You know, Henrik Larsson would not be playing for Celtic in this current era. John Hartson, Chris Sutton, Neil Lennon, Alan Thompson would not be playing for Celtic in this current era. Or if they were, they'd be the kind of Virgil van Dijk type model where it's a couple of years and then they're off. So the ability, I suppose, to get the Nakamura and keep them at Celtic Park for long enough to and have them in their prime is tough. So we still are at that disadvantage, and there's a reality that we all have to accept that we're not going to get to the point where, you know, if you look at Tottenham with Keeson Young, that's our player. He's in his prime. He's playing in the Premier League. Tottenham aren't the biggest team in the Premier League, but they, if you look, obviously not right now, but if you look at the stadium when we were able to go in, there was a large Korean contingent buying tickets at a premium to watch Tottenham because of him. And then obviously when you take that into their market, he's the biggest sports star in Korea. Now, so we aren't going to get those players. But the point is, if we can find a player like that, even for a couple of years, we can absolutely leverage that opportunity. And that will bring in, sometimes those players bring sponsors with them because they're just a kind of, you know, a superstar in the making from those markets and they've got brands associated with them. So that can come part of it. But obviously, we're not going to get them for a huge amount of time. I think the thing I would say as well is without trying to be too technical, because the other thing that I think has been discussed because of the new CEO coming in has been things like the stadium naming rights, because he did the Murrayfield BT deal. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing we've got to accept as a fan base is, on one hand, we say Celtic aren't leveraging their situation, they're ridiculous, but then we go, what a disgrace, Daffabet as a sponsor. And then also, if I can imagine a situation where if we said it's going to become the Magners Stadium, people are going to go, what a disgrace, Celtic Park's historic, how can you do that? So if you're a Celtic, what do you do? Because in that case, the brand's going to go, well, I'm going to sponsor the stadium and all the fans that I'm trying to appeal to are going to hate me because I've renamed their paradise and I'm paying a premium for it. So what's the point in doing it? So we have to accept our limitations, but also our own kind of slight contradictions that we have. And we're not the only club to do it, you know, but we've got those contradictions. So it does make it difficult. So I suppose where I would come at it is there are other ways, you know, things like digital media these days is quite a complex market. And what some of the clubs down south have started doing is offering, rather than a 3-year sponsorship, doing a sort of digital campaign over 3 months. Like Chelsea and Duracell did one around Christmas where they just became a part. So rather than signing up for 3 years and associating themselves with the club, they did a 3-month deal where they just wanted to use some of the club's assets to help with the campaign they were doing. I think there are things like that we could offer more, you know, if it's a short term piece, if we're in Europe, for example, or also there's a channel in digital marketing called Programmatic where it's essentially automated. So basically, you'd put your assets you're willing to sell. So, you know, like the banners and stuff you see around the websites, you put that into an online engine and brands just type in. They don't seek out Celtic or a certain website. They just put in, I want this kind of 16 to 34 year old males. I want this kind of response from it. And it generates an automatic plan for them. So those advertisers aren't buying into Celtic. We're just leveraging money that comes from the digital ecosystem that's out there. And for me, we've got probably a highly engaged audience that look at our content. The downside of it is you end up with brands like Go Compare the Market. It's quite commoditized, you know, low value brands, but it's money that's on the table that we could leverage on the basis that we aren't going to go out and get you know, Pepsi as our shirt sponsor, because why would they do it? So I think whilst I understand the limitations and I do sympathise with the club and stuff, there are other things I think we could be trying that would make more money for us and perhaps be a bit more innovative. But as I say, the way I sympathise with them is it's like contradiction we have as fans, and we want them to do one thing on one hand, but then when they do it, we go, no, that's not right.
There's just toss this out here for a conversation starter. We get the big money from Pepsi, big red, white and blue logo.
Bad example, isn't it?
What do we do?
Well, that's another exact thing, isn't it? I mean, you got to take it, right? Surely, you've got to take it. I mean, because otherwise they've got to leverage the money that they can get. And if Pepsi's a big brand, Pepsi will probably put some marketing investment in to help Celtic build their brand. The colours, come on, you know, we always criticise the other side of Glasgow for, you know, not liking green football boots and stuff. So are we going to do the same thing, or are we going to, if we want more money, let's take it. Just, you know, it's one logo on the front of the shirt. It doesn't look right, but I'd do it.
Every time I see a Spurs jersey, Spurs always seem to have a red sponsor these days.
Yeah, it's true.
And it really grates me, you know, as a sort of quasi-Spurs sympathiser in my youth. I wouldn't be having it. My attempt would be to get Pepsi to negotiate some kind of green, white, red version of it.
Are they 7-Up or Sprite, Pepsi?
7-Up.
7-Up, yeah. So maybe... for domestic games, they have 7-Up on the jersey to keep people a bit more calm.
I'll leave that negotiation to you guys on that one.
Any other questions, Anthony?
I'm intrigued. How long have you been in this racket, Stephen? Have you seen a massive change? Like, have you been in it 10 years, 15 years, 2 years? I don't know.
16 years.
All right. So you must have seen a spectacular change in how this happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I don't like when people say yes and no, but the truth is that is the situation. So when I first came into the industry, you know, I kind of came in as a graduate and have gradually worked my way. I'm managing director of my company at the moment. So I've kind of come, you know, I didn't come into the industry with a load of knowledge. I've had to build that over the years. So, you know, when I first came in, I maybe missed things that were happening that I wouldn't miss now. But I suppose my impression of way things have gone is sponsorship is still largely CEO based. You know, the CEO, you know, we're dealing with a brand at the moment where we sort of made a very strong business case for a football sponsorship. And then the client in question, who was the decision maker, just decided they wanted to do a rugby. And we looked at the side by side, and they don't stack up next to each other. But it's just that person is a rugby fan, not a football fan, and wants to do it. So there's still that dynamic. And that's been, everyone talked in our industry a few years ago about that having gone, and it has reduced, but it still happens a lot. And what it lacks, our industry, I think, is robust measurement to prove the impact of what a sponsorship does, aside from kind of media value equivalents. So I suppose that's been kind of an issue that the industry's had, and actually COVID, funnily enough, has made that sharper, because investment in marketing is going to be scrutinized heavily when they've got less of it and what have you. So if you haven't got something, if you've got a channel, you know, sponsorship versus TV advertising versus outdoor billboards and so on, if you can't prove the impact of sponsorship and they've got less money to spend and they want to make sure the money they do spend has its impact, sponsorship might struggle. So that has evolved, but it's been a problem since I've been in it. But I think the main thing for me has been over the years, the change from, I suppose, the original buying things just to be on it, on the shirt. And I'm not saying that's gone entirely, but I mean, one of the first clients I worked with was Vodafone. And at the time they sponsored Man United, Ferrari F1, then latterly McLaren, and then the England cricket team. And really that was about just, you might remember Vodafone's brand tagline back then was just, how are you, I think. So they were just announcing themselves as a brand. And in a market that's a bit commoditized, because what's the real difference between Vodafone, O2, 3, et cetera, EE, et cetera. And then, but over the years, because their brand became more sophisticated, it was kind of their brand, tagline changed to power to you. So actually the way they wanted to use sponsorship became a little bit more intricated. It's not just about the branding. It's about how can we use assets, whether it's tickets, access to players, other sort of on the pitch activation rights to actually deliver something that talks about their brand. And that's where the industry is going now. It's again, the branding is one of the strengths that sponsorship has, but it's now about how can you go deeper than that and actually create something, a marketing platform that allows you to communicate your brand through the thing you're sponsoring. And that's because obviously what you're leveraging with the sponsorship, say if you're a Celtic sponsor, one thing you have got is you've got an attentive audience. If you were to offer Celtic fans the chance to do something exclusive through your product, you're likely to get a response more so than you would if you just went to them, hey, try our product, please. If you say, if you try our product and have the chance to win a season ticket or, you know, something like that, you're going to get a response. So actually it's got an attractiveness to it because it elicits more of a response. And that's where the industry is going now. It's about trying to create those marketing platforms rather than just an exposure piece.
Interestingly, you touched on the thing there with the client who the evidence suggests that they should be associated with football, but the CEO prefers rugby.
Yeah.
And again, this is just a perception as an outsider, so you can tell me if this is the case. My perception is international brands and European-based companies see the value of football, and particularly the value of the English Premiership.
Mm-hmm.
My perception is that British-based companies prefer rugby to football. Again, this gets back to the class thing in UK still being. Is that the case, or is that my anti-rugby prejudices coming into play here?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can't say it's an absolute thing because I suppose in defence of the industry, there are a lot of brands and CEOs and marketing directors that look at the facts and make the decision based on the facts rather than a personal preference. However, I think what you touch on, the class thing, is it's not just a sponsorship thing. I mean, you know, personal opinion of mine, I think it's a bit of a disgrace that the way that it was handled at the weekend with obviously the players, a large proportion of the Scotland and England players not taking the knee, the way that was covered, because if that was one football player, they would be condemned by the media as the Antichrist. Now, whatever people think of taking the knee or not, what it represents and what have you, the reality is the footballer would have been crucified for doing that. However, number one, it was hardly even mentioned on media at all that it happened. And second of all, when it was covered, because I spent the evening, to be honest with you, continually searching BBC and other and on Twitter, and I couldn't really find. I only found one article in the Daily Mail and one article in Sport Bible, and both of those articles talked about why they were doing it. You know, which again might be the right way to consider things in a balanced way, rather than just condemning immediately. But I suppose where I'm coming at is because of the kind of slight elitist nature of it, and if you look at the, you know, this is getting away from marketing, but the way the power is divided up in our country, it is protecting their own a little bit. So if you look at, you know, marketing does have a diversity and inclusion issue. You know, because I'm a managing director of an agency, we try and make our workforce isn't as diverse and inclusive as it could be. And that's partly because our industry isn't well known, but the people that know about our industry tend to be white, middle class, largely, not exclusively. And then that's what's peddled it. So as a result, you kind of, and then that's the same in the marketing industry over. So I suppose what you tend to get is perhaps people that are maybe more sympathetic to sports like rugby and cricket. So there is some of that in terms of their preference. And I suppose rugby fans do have a thing of being anti-football, yeah, just by nature. So there is a bit of that, but I can't say it's a widespread thing. It's just, I suppose it's a mirror. It mirrors the sort of society that we live in.
Stephen, what's the, in your company, your business or whatever, is the sort of creative element, is that in-house or is that consultants that come in, or how is that dealt with?
My business is, we position ourselves slightly more as a strategic consultancy. So we probably do more of the what you should do and why you should do it, and then set up the overall positioning of how you should take it to market. And obviously a lot of the big brands, so take Nissan or PepsiCo, who have obviously got huge marketing investments, they do tend to have a sort of quite specific agency roster. So you'll have, we're the kind of sports marketing agency, so we're in our bucket there. When it comes to a creative task, they have a creative agency. So that always gets handed to them. So large, in some of our big things, we would set the kind of direction, but then hand that over to the creative agency to deliver. Now, we do offer that creative service in-house, and some of our smaller clients do leverage it. But so it's a bit of a mixed bag. But yeah, the marketing industry is kind of cut up between, creative advertising, so the creation of ads, the media side of it, so the planning and buying of the places you put those ads, things like PR, of how you leverage not bought advertising, social media. So it all tends to be chunked up. So that tends to be how it operates.
Was last night a big night for you? Of course, it was a Super Bowl of advertising.
Yeah, so with us being, where my business is more EMEA focused, so we don't have, we do have a sister agency, because we're owned by a bigger group, so we have a sister agency in the US who do a hell of a lot of work there. For me personally, other than following it with interest from a career perspective, we are not that involved in the Super Bowl. But again, I mean, I've never understood. I mean, I always think, I don't quite understand. I mentioned earlier the sort of strange perception the marketing industry has of itself, that people care more than they do. I always try and say to people, you know, most people, especially that work in sports marketing, tend to be sports fans. And when you're coming up with ideas for how brands should show up in advertising around sport, think, like, you're a fan. Would you want to watch this? Would you want to engage with this? And we tend to forget that a little bit. And I think almost the Super Bowl advertising, it's become part of the experience over there, but I just, what does it do? I mean, 3 months later, could anyone remember anything that they saw in the advertising? That's the thing. I suppose I question the price they pay and what they get back from it.
So just Anthony there mentioning the Super Bowl, and we've obviously talked Far East and Europe, and you've been talking about these trends for, like, the Duracell relationship, yeah, with Chelsea. Where do these trends, where is it, without giving away the company secrets, where is it that you look for the trends of what the future of sports marketing is going to be? Do you, you know, is it America? Is it the Far East? Is it Europe? Is it here in Europe that we're the innovators? Where is it? Or is it a mixture these days?
I suppose the two places, for different reasons, are the US and Asia. Europe tends, I mean, not that Europe doesn't, but we, if you take, for example, I think one of the big opportunities Celtic has, which didn't actually come up, but it's a good opportunity actually for me to talk about it, is the stadium itself. So if you look at the US stadiums, and they're a bit more fortunate because they've built a lot recently, so they're new, but in those stadiums they are what would be called connected stadiums, so you can get proper Wi-Fi, and I don't know if you've tried to use the Wi-Fi at Celtic Park. Yeah, I'll leave that there. But they, you know, and things like you can order food and drink to your seat. They've got, you know, the ways that you access the stadium through digital tickets offers other, and then that offers opportunities for sponsors. So, you know, by knowing more about you through that infrastructure, whether it's your season tickets on this card, what you buy in the stadium, it's all bought through this card. Sponsors can then target you with certain things. If they know, for example, I know people are in GDPR, might be people are question why their data is used. But if you take from a sponsor perspective, if Adidas, obviously the current Celtic kit manufacturer, knew that you'd got into the Celtic superstore and bought a Celtic shirt in a size medium or whatever, they can start targeting you with stuff that's more relevant to you and more likely to take an action. But we've got 60, you know, again, one of the advantages we have is 52,000, whatever it is, season ticket holders, largely full stadium week in, week out. We should be looking at how we can use our stadium infrastructure and advance it so we can offer opportunities. And that comes from the US, because they've taken a lead on that. And also, you know, their sports, if you think, it is a bit different, because, you know, I was actually arguing, I'm not a big NFL fan. I was arguing with my dad and some other family members on a WhatsApp group last night, because, you know, the ball's in play in the NFL for about 10 minutes a match. But it's on for about 5 hours, which I can't get my head around. I just think it's bonkers. But the reason that is it's built for marketing. It wasn't built first and foremost as a sport. It was built to have loads of breaks, so you can have the official coin toss sponsored by Ford. You can have the yellow flag on the pitch sponsored by, you know, that, and that wouldn't cut it in Europe. Football's you know, fans would revolt against that kind of stuff. They accept advertising because it's been part of it, but things like that they wouldn't accept now. So there are certain things America do to make more money than us because it's been part of their sport forever that we can't really do here that easily. But things like the Connected Stadium, I think, is a huge example, a huge opportunity. And Celtic being having a relatively modern, so I don't think we'd have to do huge amounts to install some of the infrastructure with 60,000 people in the stadium is a massive opportunity. And I think, so that's the US. I think the other, when I mentioned Asia, what that is a bit different. That is, obviously, they have gone through boom years for the last decade and plus. And they just have money to spend. You know, if you, I think obviously there's a big debate at the moment around gambling brands and their association with football. In the Premier League, I think I'm right in saying that it's 14 of the 20 have gambling sponsorships from the Far East. And it's just a source of money. So these brands are just pumping money into football and perhaps look at, and sport generally, but, and they also perhaps look at it less strategically. They'll look at it as, either it's brand building to say we are associated with the World Cup, with Man United, with the Premier League, or it's because things like in China, the reason gambling brands are so prevalent is because you can't advertise gambling in China. But what they can do is if they sponsor Wolves, even though Wolves aren't the biggest team, they can put a picture of a player on a bill on a side of a building with their brand on the front of the shirt. So it's a way around the kind of legislation, so to speak. So there's that side of the market tends to be, I suppose, less mature in terms of the way they approach it, but has money to burn and reasons to buy. And then the US tend to be slightly more innovative in the way they look at stadium infrastructure and just the fact that they're built for marketing. In Europe, we are probably more, I suppose, aware of how the fan thinks. And in Europe, we've got that kind of, you know, football fans in Europe have always been football fans and don't want their game to be messed with. Mm-hmm. We have to be aware of that. And as a result, we are slightly restricted. But I suppose what it makes us is maybe more strategic in terms of how we use assets. It's not just in your face, you know, this particular moment is sponsored by, this is sponsored by. We do other things around it that maybe are slightly more seen by less people, but maybe more powerful to the people it is seen by. So, yeah, that's the kind of, again, but slightly general, but that's the kind of dynamic you see.
You in, Anthony?
It's a way back now, but I was just thinking about the poor mugs that sponsored, you know, Rangers getting a red card, and you know, the false economy of that investment. But
I know.
But so the gist of what I'm hearing from you, I mean, again, the reason why I find this interesting is it's about maximising the money that we can generate to maximise the amount of players in the park. And what I'm sort of hearing is we're not going to go out and have Google on the jersey and Pepsi on sponsoring the team bus. It's actually a lot harder work, for want of a better way of putting it, because we've got to work hard at getting an extra 2 or 3% everywhere to get that bigger sum. Is that a good summation?
It is. And I think that's what I mean in terms of, you know, I have to say, if you look at Rangers, I actually know their commercial director. He used to work at UEFA. He's a guy called James Bisgrove, and he went in there about 18 months ago. And they've done things, you know, I know they got a lot of stick for the Castore, or however you say it, deal. But they've also done things like there's platforms where they've just gone on. I suppose, like I was saying before, about inventory that's not sold to sponsors, and they just put it on a platform that brands can come in and buy for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And now this isn't going to be, if you were winning the Champions League, you wouldn't do that because you're damaging your brand. But in our position, and obviously Rangers being until recently below us, they're just maximizing extra money that they can make, those extra 1 to 2%. And I guess that's where I'd come out from Celtic. My question to them would be, have you looked into all the money that's available that's on the table to make a decision about which of those you activate? And my impression from the outside is they haven't. And as I say, it's not about going and saying you should now get Google on the shirt. Why haven't you? Because Celtic was founded in 1887, 88. We've got great fans, history, first British team to win. It's not that. It's looking at what do we have in our arsenal that we can make money on. Some of it you might decide at the end of the day, you know, we don't want Go Compare around Celtic's website. So fair enough, you don't activate it, but you know that there's that money potentially available to you, and you make a decision on what you do it. I suppose I'm just, we just tend to go down a traditional route of getting a shirt sponsor, getting someone on the back of the shirt, you know, doing the Cadbury's deal that was done recently. Was we were one of the last ones. They were doing hoovering up clubs around the UK. So I wouldn't say that was Celtic being proactive. That was just, I think that came to them, if I was being honest. But have we used the foundation to go out to brands to talk? That's what I'm talking about. It's these, they're not going to be £80 million deals that you see in other teams making, but they're all these little bit extra that just adds to the money that we could make. That helps, that, you know, but obviously my other counterpoint is I sympathize with their position, but almost my criticism then going back would be, I sympathize, but have you then said, well, we can't change that, so what can we do? I suppose that's not, I don't think they've done that enough.
Interesting, getting back to Anthony's question about you've been in this industry for 16 years and you've seen changes but not seen changes. Mm. I suppose that then, part of what you're describing to me, what's resonating with me, is we've got a non-executive board that doesn't change, so we're not getting that feedback down to the executives and people in other industries and other companies that are seeing these types of changes. We've got a chief executive who's been there for 17 years, and we've got an executive management team who have all been there, as far as I'm aware, 10 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hearing from your description is a lot of these marginal benefits that you can get are all relatively new, taking advantage of technology as it's changing. And do you think part of the issue might be we just don't have the people who are aware that these things are out there, and that's why Cadbury's knocking our door rather than us knocking on Cadbury's?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, again, without knowing the individuals, you know, I can't say for sure, but you know, at most big brands, if we're wanting to become a big brand, they have a cycle of people that change, and the length of service, and football generally does have these long services, so it isn't just Celtic, but you don't tend to have I know Celtic don't have the equivalent, but a chief marketing officer that's there for 15 plus years. The average life cycle of a marketing director is something like 3 or 4 years. That's partly because, you know, they sometimes get fired for taking risks and it's a bit cutthroat, but also it's partly because, as to your point, trends change and evolve. But I think, you know, I've been at my company for, I've got to be careful what I say, because I've been at my company for
about
12 years, so I might be talking myself out of a job. But you can read things, you can look at what's going on, you can, you know, so I guess what I'm getting at is, whether it's about length of service and being a bit long in the tooth and not moving with the times could be one thing. The other thing is, are they challenging themselves enough? Are they doing that? Because no matter how long you've been doing something, you can always still learn more about it and try things. You know, if Celtic had tried that programmatic, I was saying, and if it didn't work, how many people would have known? What would they have lost? That's the kind of thing that, again, I am slightly speculating because I don't work with Celtic or speak to anyone on the board regularly. So I can't say for sure, but it seems to me that they're not trying these things that are perhaps low risk. And the benefit, even if it's not 50, 60 million, 10 million even, the risk versus rewards is stacked in the reward favour. So give it a try. That's a bit, I'm kind of slightly, it slightly gets on my nerves, I guess, as a fan wanting to see the club progress. It worries me that we're not progressive in our approach.
I fancy myself as a bit of a Don Draper, right? I'm an ideas man, right? Yep. Here's the idea. Here's a moneymaker that the club, I've tweeted out before about this idea, and it gets an initial, oh, no, 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 and then you get them dripping in the retweets saying, no, that is a good idea. That is a good idea. Who's which sport brand in the US sells the most apparel from the whole USA?
I don't know for sure. I mean, I would guess Nike, but it might be Under Armour or someone.
No, I mean which franchise? Oh,
like Boston Celtics?
Someone like that, right?
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
It's Notre Dame University.
Right.
Right? They sell loads of T-shirts, loads of sweaters, loads of hats. Obviously, you've got your Yankees hats and your Boston hats, but Notre Dame sell crazy numbers, right? A navy blue and gold away kit. Nobody had, you can't have blue in a Celtic shirt. you kind of, it's our ladies' colour. They would sell millions of them.
Not in Glasgow, they wouldn't.
They would.
Navy blue.
So what, navy blue and gold away strip.
So just so I understand, you're saying that by mirroring the Notre Dame colours, people around the world would buy a Celtic kit. Are you saying they'd mistake it for Notre Dame?
I think Irish expats across the planet, they're fighting Irish. They'd buy into it.
But why wouldn't they buy into the current stuff?
Because it's not blue and gold. It's not Notre Dame's colours.
Right. Yeah, it's Boston Celtic. You can tell this hasn't gone down well.
Yeah. And I'm not convinced by this.
You're both wrong. You're both wrong.
Right, so we touched on this earlier. We've got a new chief executive who's coming from, we're moving from a conservative, prudent accountant to a chief executive who's you know, everybody talks about. He's from the comms side, as if everybody knows exactly what that means, and PR, and that seems to be his expertise. Steve, are you expecting much change in Celtic on the back of that type of chief executive?
My prediction would be no, to be honest with you. I mean, well, that's maybe a bit unfair. I think he does. I mean, I don't know him for a start, so I can't speak with much authority, to be honest. But, you know, reading about him and what he's done for Scottish rugby, I think is impressive. And I think he does seem to be innovative. But I think perhaps doing that at Scottish rugby is a bit easier than doing it at an institution like Celtic. I think Scottish rugby, you know, wouldn't really need the money from the commercial side. I'm not saying Celtic don't, but, you know, Scottish rugby really do. And I perhaps, would my suspicion would be, whilst it won't be easy, I imagine he's probably got a bit more complete autonomy to do things at Scottish rugby that perhaps he might not have at Celtic, with obviously the majority shareholder, the board that sit there. So, and, you know, the board, obviously, I think, clearly have been very happy with the way things have been. So are they going to have the appetite to try a load of new stuff? My question would be perhaps not. Now, you've got to assume that the CEO will be aware. He's a Celtic fan, right? So he's the new CEO. Yeah. So he's going to be aware of, I suppose, what the fans are saying. So you'd imagine that in order to get the fans on side, he will want to do something that does that. But I'd imagine, rather than the commercial marketing side, that's probably going to be more on the playing side. So whether it's a big name manager, whether it's a bit of money spent on signings, I'd imagine that would be where he'd look to make his initial impact. It's probably what I would do if I were him, because it's, you know, if we suddenly launched a programmatic advertising network, if you tell that to fans, and this isn't a criticism of the fans, they're going to go, what the hell are you talking about? But if you go, here's Rafa Benitez, they're going to go, wow, amazing, what a first thing he's done. So I'd imagine that will be where he focuses his initial impact. So, but, and I think because of the structure at Celtic, you know, I think the current CEO, from what I hear, again, seems to be across everything. So I think, again, if I were to advise him, I'd want him to almost hand over a bit of responsibility, so the commercial team feel that they've got a bit more freedom, rather than the CEO, who's our current CEO, is his accountant background, is it? Am I right in saying?
He's an accountant and he's a micromanager from what I'm aware.
That obviously perhaps has a why they're maybe not going to be innovative on marketing commercial, because it's not his background. If you give a bit, I know this guy maybe is, but if you give a brief and a strategy, but then allow them to operate within that strategy, you're probably going to get more results. So hopefully, maybe if he's less of a micromanager, we might see generally think better things coming out of it, rather than it being all controlled by one person who's got, for all the talent he may have in one area, you can't be across everything. You need people. Most CEOs would say, I need people around me that can do the things I can't do. So hopefully he has that approach, but time will tell. But yeah, I think he'll probably, the playing side of things will be where he focuses to start with, which I think is probably the right thing to do.
What's your thoughts? Just you talk about marketing, and what's your thoughts on the Celtic Christmas adverts? Because one of the things I've noticed is in terms of the Scottish sports media, they've almost had they've started to have the presence that the John Lewis advert has.
Yeah.
That Celtic's advert coming out today is a news item in itself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's clever. I mean, again, in my work, we talk a lot about the John Lewis type ads. And in a way, it's kind of when they first did it, John Lewis, if I'll come back to Celtic in a second, but I think it was kind of, oh, wow, this is something new you hadn't seen before. They've now almost created a problem for themselves because people expect it every year. And it's almost become more, in my view, is what, again, I don't work with John Lewis, so again, I don't have in-depth knowledge of exactly the results it yields, but I would question, you know, it cost them a lot to produce those ads. I don't know about Celtic. It probably doesn't because they're using, you know, internal assets and stuff. I'll come back to Celtic, but John Lewis, it cost them a lot of money to produce those adverts because they've got to up their game year on year on year. And almost it becomes the point where, given what social media is like, they almost can't win because they're going to get criticised because everyone's going to like the previous one or one from 2 years ago. So in a way, it's almost all this money they're spending is doing more damage. And whilst they obviously feature John Lewis products in their ad, you're kind of like, well, people shop at John Lewis at Christmas anyway. The products you can buy at John Lewis, you can get somewhere else. What benefit is this doing for John Lewis other than a bit of talking about John Lewis, but it's a brand that most people know anyway. And does it have an uplift on sales? I suppose Celtic's a bit different. I think it's quite a clever thing they've done because it's kind of one of the only times you see the players in a slightly more relaxed, jovial mood. So it gives Celtic fans and fans of other teams who maybe aren't quite as, maybe in England, for example, who aren't necessarily as passionately for or against Celtic, a chance to see something that's quite a football team with players that normally are machines when they're interviewed, doing something a little bit different. So it helps the sort of brand Celtic. And actually for them, when they're looking to sell merchandise, you know, if you're buying stuff for family, yeah, you might look at, say, I'll get my son the next new Celtic jersey. But all the stuff else that's in it, whether it's, you know, the dressing gowns, the onesies, those kind of things, I think it's good publicity for those products and probably helps them sell more than they perhaps would if they didn't do something like that. And the cost for them is they don't put it on television. They stick it on their social media channel and it gets picked up by all the news outlets. People retweet it and they're away. So the cost versus reward, I think, for them is smart. Whereas John Lewis have to spend millions producing it, millions getting it in front of people, and then it gets potentially slated, and what does it do for their business? So I think it's that's what I'm talking about, I suppose, Eric. Maybe it's a good example I should have used, but an example of, you know, creating content that's a bit brand Celtic that people will watch, and then there's a role for brands within that potentially. That's the kind of thing I think that's a smart thing to do. So yeah, I think it's very, very good. I don't think this year's one or 2020 was as good as 2019's, but that's a moot point as such.
So on to more mundane things. One final question on branding. How hurtful to Celtic will this catastrophic season have been? Or can we just move on and provided next season's better, will Adidas not really bother?
Yeah, I mean, Adidas's deal is based around the sales of merchandise because they will... You know, Celtic will be, the deal will obviously be they'll pay Celtic the rights to be the partner and they'll probably pay Celtic a royalty for everything sold. But really, Adidas will make the money from Celtic jerseys, the majority of the money from the Celtic jerseys sold. So on that basis, I would reckon that Celtic win or lose, I was having this debate with my family actually, Celtic won't sell, you know, there won't be a huge reduction in Celtic shirts sold year on year because we didn't win 10 in a row. Now there will be some reduction because when you're winning more, you know, it's just success breeds success. Uh-huh. So I'm not saying there'll be no impact, but I think with Celtic being the kind of club it is where our fans are so committed, it won't be as much of an impact. So I don't think Adidas will do anything drastic. Also, the Adidas deal is over a period of years. Now, if we continue losing and shirt sales drop and drop and drop, our likelihood to renew at the same level we signed at will be diminished, and we won't make as much money. So there is a reality that it will have an impact, but this one season I don't think will change. Where they will lose out is imagine all the 10 in a row merchandise they could have sold. I mean, that's where it's, and whether that's Adidas or not, that's potentially huge. I don't know the money involved in that, but that is massive.
So what's the new Can you shed any light on the thing that was launched at the weekend with a couple of errors because they used the term Old Firm? Was it Dugout?
Yes. So Dugout is a platform that was set up a number of years ago, and it was a smart idea, actually. What they did was they, if you think that there are so many clubs around Europe that are big clubs, but perhaps don't get the views and coverage that they would, that they perhaps would get, because they do things on their own. So say AC Milan, for example, massive club, not now playing in the biggest league, but one of the biggest leagues, obviously has a huge history and a large number of fans. But how many fans in, how many football fans in the UK, Germany, Spain, France, so on and so on, will follow AC Milan on Twitter and engage with their content? Probably quite a small number compared to what they could be, as you know, given who they are. So what Dugout did was they said, well, actually, there are so many clubs like that. You know, if you take some of the Valencia, Atletico Madrid, you know, some of the English clubs, teams like Celtic. I mean, we're quite late on now, but, you know, PSV, Ajax, so on and so on. What they did was they went to those clubs and said, look, we're going to create a sort of a central platform where you give us access to all your stuff so a fan can come to us. And the reason they'll come to us is because it's not just about AC Milan. They'll go on there and they'll see AC Milan, they'll see Ajax, they'll see Arsenal, they'll see... So it's kind of a, for big football clubs who aren't able to do it on their own, but collectively with other similar clubs, it becomes something quite big. And what they did was, commercially, they made the founding clubs, which I think was eight or 10 clubs, they made them shareholders and part owners of Dugout, the company. And they offer them a revenue share of all advertising sales around their content. So the club is offering their content for free on the basis that they have equity in it from ad revenue. Now, what they've done since, once they proved it with their 8 to 10 founding clubs, they've then added clubs on afterwards who leverage now the scale that they provide. Rather than making them owners of the company, they just offer them this ad revenue share. So Celtic's different, you know, Celtic will be now placed in an environment alongside other clubs, so it might give us some incremental views and advertising around that. Where Dugout have made the most, so that's kind of the platform in a nutshell and how it, and why clubs buy into it. But Dugout as its own website, app, whatever, hasn't really taken off. You know, it's not ubiquitous across football. But what they did that was quite clever, they created a player, so a kind of unit that they embed into news platforms, websites. So say Daily Mail are writing an article about an upcoming Champions League game where it's, I'm trying to give an example, AC Milan playing Arsenal. So they're doing a feature on AC Milan. Because Dugout have got access to all AC Milan's content, they can embed their player in the Daily Mail website and it'll be like the top 10 AC Milan goals this season. So it's kind of supplementary content around. So it's good for the Daily Mail because they're kind of keeping people on the site. And obviously the size of Daily Mail's audience means that the Dugout views are huge. So they get more advertising revenue that they can then pass back to the clubs. So that's where Celtic, I think, will potentially benefit. If there's any articles about Celtic in Europe, their player gets embedded, we'll get an ad share of all that money that comes through. So, and our price for doing that is we offer our content out to Dugout sort of for free, in inverted commas, on the basis we'll get that payback. So that's kind of the basis of the deal. It's been going for a few years. So as I say, we're quite late on, but there should be an uplift.
Would this be original content, or would this just be like money for Old Rogue from Celtic TV?
It's a bit of a, I mean, obviously, Dugout want original because people are going to go to their platform if it's something you can't see elsewhere. But obviously it's not entirely, because if you think about it, the dynamic they've kind of captured on is fans that perhaps won't follow Celtic, but if they see a video, will watch it. So the fact that it's on Celtic social media doesn't take away the exclusivity for Dugout, really, because you're probably talking to an audience that aren't already following Celtic, so won't have seen it. But obviously, you know, for example, Paris Saint-Germain is one of the clubs, and when Neymar signed, Dugout got the kind of official behind-the-scenes view of him arriving in Paris and all that kind of stuff. So there is a mix of it. And obviously the reason for PSG to do that rather than their own platforms was if Dugout can leverage a bigger audience and then more, and as a result, advertising money is better, they'll get more of the money back than they would if they just put it out on PSG social media. So that's the kind of dynamic. So it should be all uplift for us. the quantities, I'm not sure, but it should just be by us offering that content, we should see money back from it. I think it's, when I've met the Dugout guys a few times over the years, and I've always said to them, get Celtic on board. So I think it's a deal Celtic should have done. I don't know why it's taken this long, but it should result in some uplift for us money wise. And also brand wise, because we're potentially viewed alongside clubs that, we're on a platform where fans wouldn't have viewed us otherwise.
Yeah, so from that perspective, from a brand perspective, it sounds to me as if this is only a benefit to us because it's elevating us to, yes, here is a football club that's of a similar stature to AC Milan, PSG, Arsenal, these other elite clubs in Europe. So from that perspective, it's lifting us up and saying they're not just a Scottish club, they're one of these elite clubs.
Exactly. And this is where the content from like the stadium, fans aren't going to seek out Celtic social media to watch the fans sing You Never Walk Alone. But if it's on Dugout and it comes up, they've watched the video of Arsenal and it says suggested next Celtic fans sing You Never Walk Alone, they're going to watch it and they're going to go, oh, that's impressive. So we're going to get people seeing us and being impressed, hopefully, that wouldn't have seen us otherwise.
So again, kept you long enough. So through this conversation, one of the things that's really, really struck home to me, I've had plenty of conversations in this podcast before about if we want to be a player trading club and we want to buy the very best players we can, and we'll sell them and then get better players in and sell them. The only way we're going to get optimum value for those players is playing Champions League football and not really focusing, much as losing out on 10 in a row has not been something that any of us in this conversation want, but really stop navel gazing at domestic football, and it's only success in Europe that's going to drive that. Everything we've talked about today has pretty much been around, we'll get that incremental increase in value by performing on a bigger European stage.
Completely. Funny enough, I was asked, what would you rather? Celtic got to the Champions League last 16 twice, or Celtic win 10 in a row? And for me, from a business perspective, it's the former, it's the Champions League. 10 in a row, like Juventus are going for their 10th title in a row this year. No one knows about it, and outside of Italy maybe, but I don't even think it's been. I know the Celtic Rangers dynamic, because we've both done 9, makes it different. I don't know if that exists in Italy, but it's not other than in Scotland, which I'm not saying is not important, but it's not a big thing. Whereas Champions League, 25-30 million every year, by nature of that, we should win 10 in a row, because the product on the pitch, the sponsor, the money should be better. So I think the biggest failing in 10 in a row, if I'm honest with you, is not when we had no Rangers at all, and then obviously lastly when they've come in and we've been streets ahead, has been not capitalising on the advantage we had of almost, and the qualifiers haven't been the most difficult. We should be beating a lot of these teams. I know the odd time, I'm not saying they should do it every time. You can't, some of these teams are playing, they're halfway through their season and we're coming in fresh. So, it's not as easy to say we should have qualified every year, but we've lost out so many times. And I think that has been more damaging to our product on the pitch and our business off the pitch than losing 10 in a row ever will be. So, yeah, it's frustrating.
So nothing would be more important than planning right now for how we perform in the European, in the Champions League qualifiers in the summer.
I mean, for me, it was, again, I'm not involved in my job in kind of the playing side of things, but it would have made sense to me, given that 10 in a row had kind of gone in early Jan, change the manager around to a manager that you're going to stay with. And obviously there's complexities to that. Is the right manager available? Do they want to come in when they're going to have to go through 6 months of losing, all the talk about losing 10 in a row? But, have the club looked at that? Because obviously we haven't really signed anyone other than obviously the loan in January. So we've got no further along for next season. But we're going to have a situation at the end of this year where likely, Edward, Ayer, so on and so on, all these players go. And we're going to have a Champions League qualifier within weeks of all that happening. how, with a new manager potentially coming in, who knows when, you know, 2 weeks before all that happening, how we potentially, by not acting, we're potentially, you know, setting ourselves up for failure for next season, domestically and potentially European, and who knows how long that effect might have. So it's slightly baffling why we haven't made a change, to be honest with you.
Okay, and what type of... So you definitely have changed the manager. What type of manager would you be going for?
Yeah, and this is the million dollar. And this is, what, again, my dad always says he was probably... He was quite hard to convince that we should have got rid of Neil Lennon. You know, and from my perspective, Neil Lennon, I don't think he's deserved some of the abuse he's got. Because, you know, but I think it was pretty clear. I mean, I wasn't in favour of his full-time appointment in the first place. But that aside, it was pretty clear from kind of October time that it wasn't working and we kept with it. So I suppose what I'm getting at is it's not easy to say the manager's name now that we should get. But I think they've had enough time to have gone and done that. And I don't think they have. And that isn't my job, obviously, to know that. But I think the kind of manager I would look for, and I'm not, and this isn't necessarily, I'm not sure how right this man is for the job, but I suppose I'm talking about the type of manager, like Eddie Howe, where he's a football coach and he develops players and works within constraints. So again, he's the one that kind of, I suppose, I know, but there's probably other managers out there beyond my kind of football knowledge. But that kind of younger, hungrier manager that's going to come in, because even if we were going to push the boat out for Rafa Benitez, great, but how long is he going to be there for, and what's the long-term benefit versus a kind of younger coach with progressive football ideas, works within a budget, can develop young players, you know, the players that we bring in that we look to sell on can work with them. I suppose the idea they had with Ronnie Dyla, that's what I would do. I don't know who that is, but that kind of manager.
Anthony?
I think, yeah, I agree 100%. You know, to go back to the 10 in a row thing, you know, the heart comes about how close we got. Mm. You know, like my dad thinking about how, you know, we got so close and then we felt the last hurdle. So that will grate, but it won't grate forever. We can still say, right, we did 2-9 in a row. That still beats your one, you know, and dying. That sucked as well. So that being the case, yeah, it would be a Dyla type, or, you know, in theory, you know, Dyla on paper. I actually quite liked Dyla for real, but for whatever reason, it went off the rails in the last 6 months. But yeah, something like that.
Mm. All right. Well, as I say, I kept you too long enough, Stephen. That's been fantastic insight. And with that, I will say thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be joining. Thanks for asking me. And speak soon, hopefully.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. There'll be more along soon. Anyway, enough of me. That was Anthony Murray with Stephen Hutchison. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Take care. Good night.
Be more happiness, so much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years, never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years, never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring